MacCast, Saturday, October 3rd, 2015. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, it's been an interesting couple weeks or week or so, I guess, in Apple and Mac news. Not a lot of news going on this week. We have a few things to talk about, some rumors about what's happening with Apple's car project. We're going to talk about tearing down some of the new iPhones. I guess we've got a lot of new iPhone 6 and 6S stuff. We're going to talk about how sales went. We haven't really talked about that yet. Also, Apple doing some more expansions and acquisitions, and a nice little update on some of the questions we had surrounding tvOS and the new Apple TV. But beyond that, because we've had a couple of operating system updates, including iOS 9 and El Capitan come out, and also the new iPhones, I've got some tips and tricks and that sort of stuff. We're going to talk a little bit of watchOS 2 came out. We haven't really talked about that, so I'm going to talk about some of the things there. I'm excited getting geared up for the new Apple TV and the iPad Pro. You probably are as well. And we'll talk about that a little bit. And then a couple questions. And I think that'll do it for today's episode. But before we get into all of that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors. And that is Smile. Now, if you've been listening to the show for any period of time, you know that I love Smile and their products. I've used them forever. They've always been installed on my Macs. And you also probably know that Smile loves podcasts. They've been a supporter of this show since the early, early days, and we love them. And a great way to show your support to them for supporting us would be to buy one or all of their great applications. And right now, they're going to make it even easier for you to do that because they are giving us a really great deal. 20% off any new licenses for PDF Pen, PDF Pen Pro, or Text Expander. So if you get a new license of any of those products, you're going to get 20% off. And you know I use PDF Pen Pro and Text Expander all the time. I don't have a single Mac that don't have these apps installed. It's like, it's just part of my default setup and installation. And that's because PDF Pen makes it so easy to edit and annotate PDFs, allows me to sign documents. I moved a couple years ago to an all-digital workflow. So if I get a document and I need to sign, or what I call a fake form, right? Those are the PDFs you get that look like a form, but they don't have any form fill-in fields. Well, PDFs, you can, and actually with PDF Pen Pro, you can actually make one of those non-PDF forms into an actual form. That's another cool feature that I've used from time to time. But another thing is if you just get one, you need to add some information to it and send it back. PDF Pen is great for that. And then add your signature and you're done. You've done it all digitally, electronically. It's really awesome. PDF Pen Pro also lets you build table of contents. You can do things like convert entire web pages to PDFs if you need to take those with you in PDF format, sort of take a snapshot of them. Great way to archive different content. And then you have Text Expander. I don't even know where to begin with Text Expander. It literally saves you time and little bits of time here and there that will add up to minutes, hours over the course of a year. And over a couple years, it's just amazing. They even have stats in there that'll show you how much time you save. Basically, expanding custom keyboard shortcuts into frequently used text, pictures. You can put rich content into your snippets. And it's really great for frequently typed stuff like addresses and signatures, maybe directions or instructions that you find you're typing out over and over again. A whole bunch more really great stuff. You know their products. We've talked about them a lot. So what I want you to do is visit smilesoftware.com/MacCast or use the code MacCast at checkout and you're going to save 20% off of new licenses of PDF Pen, PDF Pen Pro, and Text Expander. And this offer is for new Mac apps purchased directly from the Smile web store or in products. So use the URL, smilesoftware.com/maccast. You got to do it through the website or their online store. It unfortunately cannot be used for the Mac App Store versions of the application. So make sure you go to the URL. And this offer is good until October 15th. So don't wait. You got a couple weeks here. And big thank you to Smile for their continued support of the MacCast. We love them. So what do you guys think about this Apple Car rumor that Apple is targeting a 2019 release date? This came out of the Wall Street Journal. They're claiming that people familiar with Apple's rumored car project, which is supposedly called Project Titan, they're saying that they're trying to have a vehicle ready to ship to consumers in the marketplace in 2019. Seems like it's not that far away, but if you look at the ramp up that Tesla had, it seems like it could be doable. Now, for a while now, we've been hearing that Apple's been really staffing up. They're hiring a lot of heavy hitters from around the automotive industry and within technology sectors that are related to automotive type things. Actually, we're going to talk about a couple more of those in this episode a little bit later. And they really have had a big focus recently in hiring experts who are connected to, who are working in areas of connected and autonomous vehicle systems. So we've been hearing that it might be an electric car, there might be some autonomous vehicle sort of things going on there. And the current headcount, I believe, is rumored to be somewhere around 600 people. But they're saying that Apple's looking to maybe triple the amount of people working on this project. So bringing it up to about 1,800, close to 2,000 people working on the car project. And Apple Insider thinks that the entire project is being run by this shell company called 68 Research from a facility in Sunnyvale, California. And that facility is reportedly called SG5. So there's all these code names being thrown around. It's almost like it's like a spy movie, right? This is like somebody is going to, when this is all said and done, you can make a movie out of this stuff, maybe. I don't know. I'd probably go to it just because it's related to Apple. But the rumor sites are going crazy. There's also been a lot of rumors about possible sites, because if Apple does get this up and rolling, they're going to need places to do R&D, to do manufacturing. So it's been thrown around that they might have a couple different locations in mind. As a matter of fact, Apple reportedly paid about $138 million for a 43-acre site in San Jose. So we don't know what's happening with that, but they have this piece of property. It could be there. There's also some property in Sunnyvale that Apple bought recently. And again, we're going to be talking about that later, although that's looking like it's more like an office space. But I guess that could be for this sort of division or section of Apple. And really, the speculation around what the car project is has run the gamut. We've heard everything from, oh, they're just working on technologies and in-vehicle systems, they're going to partner with someone to actually, you know, do the car, all the way through Apple is building a full autonomous vehicle, a self-driving car, a la what Google is doing. And, you know, sort of in the middle, where I think I'm falling is that Apple is really going to be building a electric car, more think like something to compete with the Tesla or the BMW i3, that sort of vehicle. And if it is a reality, most of the folks, if the 2019 date is a reality, most of the people who are speculating around this seem to think that an electric car, possibly with some advanced assisted driver features, you know, so again, think like some of the things Tesla's doing with lane assist, where it'll help keep the car in the lane when you're driving down the freeway, or self-parking features, those sorts of things, but not a fully autonomous, you know, self-driving car. At least not by 2019. It may be something that Apple is playing around with. We know they've gone out, they've talked to the California DMV, and they've gone to a couple facilities looking for testing for that sort of thing. But I don't think they're going to be able to hit a 2019 date for a car if it's fully autonomous. I think this is really more about getting an electric vehicle out there from Apple. And I think I'm starting to believe more and more they probably can pull it off. There's the other question of, like, should they pull it off? And I'm not so sure how I feel about that. Or, you know, should they try to do this? Are they going to spread themselves too thin? Is this really an area that they should be even bothering to get into? You know, the car industry certainly doesn't want them to get in there, but I think they have their own agendas when it comes to that. I think they're not looking forward to the competition. And if you look at what Tesla has done and been able to do, yeah, I think they're still struggling. I don't follow them very closely, but you know, they just announced new vehicles. They're pushing forward. They get a lot of buzz when they do those sorts of things, and they're making amazing technology that's really pushing things forward. And this sort of fits in with Apple's new environmental profile as well. So I think, you know, the project is something Apple is doing. Whether they're going to be able to hit that 2019 date, I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But I'm starting to get a little more excited about it. I don't know about you. Another thing that kind of came to a head this week is the teardowns. We've got some new products out there, specifically the iPhone 6 and 6S and the Apple TV. And lucky for us, iFixit took advantage of the developer program and got one of the developer Apple TVs and a Siri remote, and they tore it down. So we know about some of the guts and some of the things that are inside of that. Specifically, they found a dual-core Apple A8 64-bit chip. We kind of knew that already, but we didn't know how much RAM. They confirmed that it's 2 gigabytes of RAM. They noted that it has a much larger heat sink and a redesigned power supply, which adds to the height. That's why it's a little bit higher. And then in breaking down the remote, I found this to be fascinating. The remote has an ARM Cortex M3 MCU. So you know, you've got some pretty good smarts built right into that little tiny Siri remote. And also interesting, it has the same Broadcom touchscreen controller that's used in the iPhone 5S, 5C, and the iPad Air. And also, you know, iFixit always gives devices a repairability score for, like, how easy it is it to open up, how easy could you do self-repairs, and they gave it an 8 out of 10, noting that it didn't have a lot of glue, or any glue really holding the bottom on, and things like the power supply looked like they could be customer serviceable. So it did very well, and so lucky for us they did that. Unlucky for them, though, that Apple was not as impressed as I was. They were a little upset that they broke the NDA because they legitimately have an iFixit app. So they had a developer license. So they are developers. But, you know, you're not supposed to disclose that sort of stuff when you're getting next generation Apple TV. You're supposed to be using that to actually build apps. And I think it's feasible to think that iFixit would possibly build an Apple TV version of their app, because the app is basically their teardown and repair guides. And some of those have videos and things like that. So that would make sense for the Apple TV. But because they tore it down and because they released the information, Apple pulled their developer license, which also means that their app got pulled from the App Store. And although if you have the app, because I actually have it, it still seems to work, at least for now. iFixit said in a blog post about this whole incident that it really had some issues with iOS 9. I've noticed little quirky sort of display issues, but nothing major. The overall functionality app still seems to work. But they say, consequently, they were working on a mobile version of their site, a mobile-optimized version of their website, and that's a better way to consume the content anyway, and you should just do that in lieu of using the app. They also did note that their app is open-sourced, so they do have the code up on GitHub, and because of how their APIs are for their website and their information, their guides on their website, they say it would be pretty easy for someone to actually build an app. So I fully expect that some creative developer out there will build a third-party iFixit app and release that to the App Store. They just said, you know, you have to do it under the open source rules, so you can't charge for it and you can't put ads in it and things like that. But I think we'll see that happening. But they kind of acted surprised. In the blog posts, I think they said they knew that they were kind of treading a thin line, and they just sort of threw caution into the wind, as it were, and just gave it a shot. Well, this is what happened, unfortunately. So I don't think they weren't expecting it. They did kind of call out Apple, and I just want to comment on this because I thought this was not right. They said that, you know, what did Apple expect we were going to do with it? We're a teardown site, and they know we're a teardown site. So why would they ship us one, not expecting that we would tear it apart? And I really think it was because on Apple's part, they figured, hey, maybe they do want to build an app for the Apple TV, and they want to do some testing on it. I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility. So I think I give Apple the benefit of the doubt on that one. So they did tear down the Apple TV, and if you want to check it out on their website, they do have it up there. They also tore down the iPhone 6S, and, you know, no big surprise, there were just a few internal changes, a couple of different part additions. It is the first iPhone to feature 2 gigabytes of RAM, so you got more RAM in there. They did note there's a slightly smaller battery than the previous generation, 1,715 milliamp hour battery. I think the other one was just over 18. And part of the reason they suspect for the smaller battery is that Apple needed some room for that new Taptic engine. And something cool, if you go check out, and I'll have a link to this in the show notes at maccast.com, if you check out the video from iFixit that's in the teardown, they have an X-ray video of the Taptic engine, so you can actually see the Taptic engine working. It's pretty fascinating. And then another interesting find was that Apple is definitely dual-sourcing the processors, the A9 processors. They're using a Samsung and TSMC, and the Samsung version seems to use a 14-nanometer process and is just a slightly smaller chip at 96 millimeters, while TSMC is using a 16-nanometer process, so its chip is 104.5 millimeters. Now, the question I have is, does it matter which processor you have? Are you going to be able to tell? And it's really unclear at this point. The one theory that's out there is that the Samsung one might be slightly more energy efficient because it uses the 14-nanometer process, but it's not clear how much more energy efficient, and I don't think day-to-day usage you're going to be able to tell just by your battery usage, you know, which one you have. And performance-wise, I don't think there's going to be a huge discrepancy either. So I think it's not going to be one of these things that doesn't really matter. But time will sort of tell on that one. And another interesting thing on the iPhone 6 with iFixit was that they gave it a 7 out of 10 on the repairability score. So again, that's pretty high marks for an Apple product in terms of repairability. So you can get in there, you can replace the screen, do minor repairs and stuff like that without too many issues. It still does have the special pentalobe screws, so you do need to get the special screwdriver. But beyond that, again, it seems like Apple's starting to use less glue and less things sealed down and making it a little bit easier with each successive version. Now, one other interesting thing about the new iPhones is it seems like they're a little bit more water-resistant than the prior generations. And we saw a couple videos, people putting them in what I'm calling the bowl of water test, dropping them in a bowl of water, letting them run for about an hour, and they came out fine. All of the functions seemed to work. The touchscreen, now I don't advise you try this with your own iPhone, but it does seem like things are a little bit better. And iFixit did a little more investigating on this and noted that there is a new sort of gasket-like seal all the way around the edge of the screen, and that's probably adding to the water resistance a little bit. And there were also some new silicone seals around all of the cable connectors. So where the cables are plugging into the logic board, those seem to be sealed up a little bit more as well. And those two things together are probably why we're seeing a little more water resistance. Now, in some of the other tests in deeper water, there was somebody, I think, who threw them into a swimming pool, maybe about 3.5 feet of water, and they didn't survive quite as well. Well, you've got more pressure there, so you're going to have more seepage in there. So I think the point here is that if you happen to get it wet, maybe you live in a wet environment or you're out in the rain or you drop it in a puddle or, God forbid, you drop it in the toilet, which is a common fate for a lot of iPhones. If you fish it out relatively quickly and just sort of dry it off and let it dry out, it's probably going to do just fine. I wouldn't go around, you know, swimming with it or anything, but it does look better. And then we're also getting some performance numbers on the new A9 processor, and they're pretty amazing. The Geekbench scores look to be about 50% faster in multi-core operations and about 60% faster in single core tasks versus the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. And most of the time, most apps are using single core tasks. So that's generally the number you want to look at a little bit more. For things like games and maybe photo processing, some of the higher end apps, that's where multi-core comes into play. And Anantech did some early benchmarks, and they think that, you know, another thing that's contributing to a little bit to the speed is the faster flash that is in the new devices and the controllers and things like that. And the GPU is helping as well. So all of those things together are combining to give some pretty impressive scores for the new iPhones. In web and graphics and many of the storage tasks, they found that the iPhone is the fastest smartphone on the market in many of the tasks. And I noted from their benchmarks that in some of them, many of them specifically related to web and graphics tasks, it was almost performing as well as a Surface Pro 3. And those have fourth generation Intel i3 processors running at 1.5 gigahertz. So, you know, that is a lower end desktop processor, but you're getting that kind of performance now out of an iPhone. So I really believe, you know, Apple, when they say on the iPad Pro, they're going to have a desktop class processor in that. And I'm looking forward to seeing that after seeing these iPhone numbers. So I think we're going to see some impressive numbers out of the iPad Pro as well. And so really, what does all this faster mean for us? You know, for us, it means that your apps are going to launch faster. They're going to load and render faster. So just generally, you're going to feel like, you know, web surfing and browsing's quicker, all those sorts of things if you get a newer iPhone. And then the last thing related to sort of the teardown and the breakdown and analysis on the new iPhones is we are starting to get component cost numbers from IHS Technology. They broke it down. And again, this is, you know, purely a reflection on the parts that go into making an iPhone. It doesn't factor in anything like, you know, shipping costs and production costs and, you know, marketing and any of those things. So, you know, there's a lot of other things outside just the material costs that go into the cost of making an iPhone. But in just looking at the component parts and what Apple is probably paying for them, they estimate that the iPhone 6S costs about $211.50 US to build, and a iPhone 6S Plus is about $236. And they did note that the most expensive component part is that new display with the 3D touch technology. They gave an estimate of about $52.50 for that. And then that is followed up by the A9 processor, which they estimate at about $22. And then, of course, all the other parts factor in from there and go into giving us that total component parts cost. The iPhone has once again broken sales records. Apple came out this week with their official numbers from opening weekend, and they say that they sold more than 13 million iPhones. That beats the previous opening weekend record of 10 million. That's from the iPhone 6S and 6 or 6 and 6 Plus launch last year. That's going to trip me up quite a bit, so pay attention. I'm probably going to keep doing that. I've probably done it a few times already, maybe even in this episode. Hopefully not. But last year, 10 million. This year, 13 million iPhones. One change that happened this year is Apple did add China as a launch day country, so that likely did help. And you also have the fact that over the years, Apple gains more and more iPhone customers, which means you have more and more people upgrading. So it's kind of this natural progression that there's going to be a built-in way for sales to continue to climb. What really ends up happening is how much are they climbing? And if you break down the number of countries from each year that Apple launched in against the number, total number of units sold, Apple did bump up the per country number as well. So it was about 1 million phones per country last year that they launched in. Obviously, this isn't, you know, 1 million in each country. Different countries are going to have different numbers. But on average, breaking it down, 1 million per country last year, about 1.8 million iPhones per country that they launched in this year. So things are improving. They are selling more phones than ever before. Another thing that happened this year that might have helped this number as well is there were about 2 weeks between the start of pre-orders and the time that it went on sale, that they were actually shipping and available in stores. That's compared to just 1 week last year. But regardless, still a very impressive number. They also announced that they're going to be rolling out sales of iPhones to another 40 countries and territories on October 9th and 10th, and that they're targeting about 130 countries by the end of the year. So a much more aggressive rollout, global rollout of the iPhone this time around. And as far as how availability is going, it does still seem to be pretty good, at least at most locations and online. The models that seem to be a little bit harder to come by are any of the Rose Gold models and also the iPhone 6S Plus. But the 6S in all the various sizes seems pretty available, and then that followed by the 6S Plus, and then Rose Gold is, I guess, the new hot color that everybody wants. So it's in a little bit short supply. And if you remember, this is what happened when Apple launched the new Gold model as well for the first time. Everybody wanted the Gold, and I think my friend Jeff Gamet pointed out to me the same thing happened with the Space Gray, right? That was the very popular color in the year that they launched it. So whatever the new, you know, the new different thing is generally seems like what the public wants. Some other quick big news for China, since we talked a little bit about China there. This week, China also got Apple Music, iTunes Movies, and iBooks. Apple says Apple Music launched with millions of songs in China and will feature Chinese artists. You get the same Apple Music 90-day free trial. But what's interesting to me about China is how Apple has adapted the pricing of the different services for the region. Apple Music in China is just 10 yuan. Yuan? I think that's how you say it. Which, if you do the math, translates to a U.S. $1.57 per month. So they're getting a great deal on Apple Music. Movies are 5 yuan, or just 79 cents for a rental, or 18 yuan, which is about $2.83 for a movie purchase. And then iBooks start at half a yuan, which is about US 8 cents. So, you know, I'm saying that's a good deal, but as we all know, different countries have different standards of living and annual salaries and things like that. So these are really adjusted for the Chinese market to make sure that they have, you know, that people can have access to this content at a reasonable rate. So I think it's the right thing for Apple to do. And it's nice to see that China is actually finally getting these things. It's getting Apple Music and iTunes Movies and iBooks. You know, being in a country like the U.S. and having them for so long, you forget that this stuff is not available everywhere. It just seems like it is, but it really isn't. So the more Apple can get it rolled out to more places, the better. Of course, in addition to expanding its products and services, Apple is also expanding physically in a couple of different areas. We talked a little bit earlier about them expanding the campus and facilities for the car project. They also have their iCloud and their data centers, and they've been expanding there as well. Apparently, Apple has purchased another 200 acres of land in Prineville, Oregon, adjacent to the current facility that they have there. They haven't confirmed their plans for the land, but it's likely to expand their data center there. They've also purchased some land, I guess, to expand the data center in Nevada as well. this new plot is actually even larger than the original plot of land in Prineville, which was 159 acres. So they're expanding there. They've also reportedly signed a lease for a 770,000 square foot campus to be built in Sunnyvale, California. Now, remember how we said earlier, Sunnyvale is reportedly, at least according to Apple Insider, where Apple's Titan car project is based. Now, it's not being said with this particular rumor that Apple has plans to use this for the car project, but that they are going to build a six-story new campus there with a lot of glass all around. If you look at these designs, they look great. The media is actually calling it a second spaceship campus. I don't think it really looks like a spaceship. It's supposedly designed to support about 3,000 employees. And the images to me, the design looks more like almost like a three-leaf clover, or some people have described it as a flower. It still has an open central quad area. One of the renderings I saw had these really nice rooftop gardens and nice spaces. It looks gorgeous. It's going to be another amazing campus if that's the design that Apple actually runs with. I think a lot of the concepts were done by the design firm to kind of show the city and to kind of get approval on. So who knows if that's going to be the actual design or not. But it looks great and just another, I don't know, giant facility. So Apple continuing to grow and expand its employees, and it needs places for all those people to work. The Financial Times is also reporting that Apple has acquired another company. They say Apple has purchased Vocal IQ, which is a United Kingdom startup that has a focus on a natural language API for allowing people to speak to computers in a more natural dialogue. Vocal IQ says its technology has the ability to learn using machine learning, and they've actually been vocally critical of Siri in the past through a blog post calling the virtual assistant a toy that's really not able to understand context. So sounds like Apple maybe agrees with them a little bit and just decided to buy the company and bring the technology in-house. They do seem to have a particular interest in voice control technology for automobiles, at least according to some of the documentation and just language that's on their website. And so this acquisition could be a two-for-one benefit for Apple, benefiting Siri and giving it more contextual, natural language processing. Also, it'd be great if Siri could learn to be more personal. So, you know, the sort of things that I'm going to ask Siri about might not be the same things that, you know, you ask Siri about. So if we could each get a more personal assistant, that would be great. And also, it sounds like this would be great technology for integrating with the Titan car project. Anything that can bring us more natural hands-free use in the car, I think, is a good thing as well. So seems like a good acquisition. Of course, Apple doesn't comment on that beyond saying that Apple purchases smaller companies all the time. And they did give their blanket statement on this one. So it pretty much has been confirmed that Apple did acquire the firm. Last thing I want to talk about is some great news for tvOS. You remember when Apple showed off the new Apple TV and the new operating system? They have this great feature that is a Siri universal search. And many of us wondered, myself included, will that be able to be available to third-party apps? Because another big part of the announcement was they were opening up the app platform and they were going to let developers build apps for the new Apple TV. Well, Tim Cook confirmed to BuzzFeed that, yes, Virginia, there is a tvOS search API. Now, I did some digging around. I couldn't see on the developer website if that search API is available, but it does sound like one exists. It's probably what the partners, you know, Netflix, Hulu, HBO, and Showtime, those are the services that are going to have universal search at launch on the Apple TV. They probably had access to that search API. And Cook did say that we're also opening an API so that others can join in. So that's really good news. He also said that the search will know which services that you're actually subscribed to and what content that you have, and will highlight the stuff that is available for free or on your existing subscriptions. I'm sure it's also going to kick back, you know, stuff that might be on a service that they're trying to promote. So say something shows up on Showtime. You don't have a subscription to Showtime. It might show that. It also kind of said that it would pull back, you know, like free episodes. So if there were paid episodes on iTunes and also free episodes maybe that were in back catalog, something that was available on Netflix of a TV show, it would sort of prioritize the free stuff, but still, I think, let you access the iTunes stuff if you wanted to pay for that. And so I think this is all really, really great news. It sounds like Apple really wants to focus on this problem of, hey, I want to sit down, I want to watch something. I don't really care where it is. What I really want to know is, you know, is there a good sci-fi movie starring, I don't know, Arnold Schwarzenegger available? And boom, it's going to show, oh, yep, we've got Total Recall over here on HBO. And, oh, remember you bought, I'm blanking on Schwarzenegger movies, Last Action Hero over here on iTunes, and you could watch that as well. And it's going to sort of prioritize that. Oh, and by the way, here's some clips from, you know, his upcoming movie that's in the trailers app or some third party app. Even better yet, here's some stuff that's on YouTube, or I don't know, I'm just throwing things out there. But you get the idea, right? That we are going to be able to have universal search, and we will be able to get search results from third party applications. So really, really good news. And I was excited to hear about that. And that news came in just right before I started recording this show. So that is late breaking news. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Now I want to talk a little bit about upgrading to El Capitan, something I'm actually not doing, but it's out now. And I know we talked about on a couple episodes ago about how to do a clean install, because many of you had asked me about that. But most of you and most people will not need to do a clean install. I'm planning to do a clean install on my Mac when I get around to doing the upgrade, but only because my hard drive has become riddled with a bunch of old junk. I was just looking. My home library folder, for example, has 125 gigabytes of junk in it, and I don't know what all that stuff is or what I need, so I just need a fresh slate, need to start over, because I'm actually literally running out of hard drive space, and I manage that pretty tightly. So I need to get that done, so I'm going to do a clean install. But what if you don't need to do that? What about, you know, just steps to get ready to do the upgrade? Just a little spring cleaning, something like that. And I guess the first place to start is, should you upgrade, or when should you upgrade? Maybe you have already. Maybe you're really enjoying El Capitan. It's getting some great reviews. It sounds like it's a pretty solid upgrade. Generally, seems so far things are going smoothly for most people. But, you know, there's always bound to be some missed bugs and issues that happen. So are you an early adopter? Are you that kind of person that should upgrade day one? Obviously, I'm not doing it. And the reason is that I have mission critical stuff that I rely on my Mac for every day. I have work that I need to get done, and that really can't be disrupted. So I kind of need to get in my schedule, you know, an amount of time where I don't have a lot going on. I know that if I run into a problem or find a bug after upgrading, that I'm going to have the time and the extra bandwidth to be able to deal with it. So if you don't have that, you might want to hold off and let the others kind of take the lead, you know, let other people take the lead, watch the blogs, listen to podcasts, and find out, you know, what issues are people having, and find out when they get fixed. You know, Apple's going to put out bug fixes, and maybe you want to jump in at version, you know, 10.11.1 or 0.2. You don't have to be there on 10.11.0. And so I say, you know, generally, if you don't mind or don't use your Mac for mission critical daily tasks, it's probably okay to upgrade. Another thing you're going to want to check and make sure is that any critical apps that you use have been upgraded and do have El Capitan compatibility. And a great place to go for that is roaringapps.com. So Roaring Like a Lion, the site was originally set up for OS X Lion. And you can go there and just plug in the app name. They have a little search, and it's all community-based, so it's crowdsourced information. Anybody can go in there. You can sign up for an account, and you can verify, yeah, I tried this app, it's working. Or you can say, I tried this app and it has these bugs or issues, or I tried this app and it's not working at all. So you can get a quick assessment of your applications and just make sure that the ones that you really need have been upgraded. So certainly do that. And then once you've decided, yeah, I'm ready to upgrade, I'm ready to go, I think, you know, a good thing to do is do a little house cleaning before you upgrade. You know, it's always easier to do it before you upgrade, get things cleaned off. It's going to make the upgrade go a little bit more smoothly, a little bit quicker. If it's not having to, you know, pull over or manage a bunch of extra data, and you'll just get your hard drive cleaned off. You also probably want to check your hard drive. So, you know, fire up Disk Utility, check the hard drive, the main hard drive, make sure that it's functioning okay. You're not, you know, experiencing any issues. And you may even want to run a quick repair permissions just for good measure. Although in El Capitan, you don't need to do repair permissions anymore. We talked about this a few episodes back. If you missed it, you're not even going to find it in the Disk Utility. It's not there. You don't need to do it anymore because the applications themselves, when you're doing installations, are going to take care of that step for you. So it's going to be sort of happening automatically. But beyond that, clean out your old documents. You know, look in your documents folder. What's all that crud you have in there? Maybe you want to archive that stuff off to another location. Get it off your main hard drive. Go through your email accounts. You know, do you really need the email from 2004? You know, all those emails, do you have to have those in there? Or can those be archived? You know, can they be stored off into an inbox file or something like that? Or photos in your photo library. You get the idea. Another thing to look for would be large files. You can use a tool like Clean My Mac to help out with this. And I will point out Clean My Mac has been a sponsor of the MacCast in the past. It's a great app. I use it quite frequently. As I mentioned earlier, I'm running out of space on my hard drive, so I'm having to find big files and clear things off quite frequently, get rid of, you know, old cache files or extra things like the iTunes Music cache. Clean My Mac can help you out with that. If you don't want to use that, you can also use a tool like Daisy Disk, which will help you find large files, so those big video files that might be hidden somewhere on your hard drive that you forgot about. It can visually show you where big chunks of data are being taken up on your hard drive. And then there's also just the system and the user caches and the general maintenance kind of files, the log files, all those sorts of things. Use a tool like Cocktail or Onyx. And I have links to all these applications in the show notes at maccast.com if you need them. Use a couple tools like that and just get things cleaned up a little bit. And then once you've done that, guess what I'm going to tell you? My mantra, backup, backup, backup. Make sure you backup before you upgrade. In general, like I said, likely nothing is going to go wrong. You're going to download the installer. You're going to run it right over the top of your current operating system. Everything's going to go beautifully. Every once in a while, someone's going to hit a bump, and you don't want it to be you. But if it is you, you want to make sure you have a backup, that you can roll back, that you have a bootable, you know, cloned backup. What I like to do is I have my Time Machine backup. I have my super duper clone backup. You can use Carbon Copy Cloner if you want. And I know that I have my backup in the cloud with CrashPlan. So I have three backups of every system that I'm going to upgrade. So I know that I'm safe. If I have an issue, I can quickly get back to square one and start over. It's good peace of mind, good to do. Hard drives are inexpensive these days. You know, $100 on a hard drive, maybe less. And you have a backup. So please do that first. And then the only other thing to note is if you do use a third-party whole disk encryption, you may want to turn that off first. Again, just in case something goes wrong, you won't be able to potentially get into that encrypted disk, you know, if things go south. So having it decrypted ahead of time is just going to make things easier. If you use Apple's built-in File Vault 2 technology, you don't have to worry about this. If for some reason you're way back on Snow Leopard and you're using File Vault 1, you probably want to disable that as well if you're going to go from Snow Leopard straight up to El Capitan. I don't think there's going to be too many of you out there that are doing that. But if you are, just something to think about. And then once you've done all that, you know, I think you're good to go. You've got things cleaned up. You've checked your hard drive. You checked your apps to make sure that they're all going to run. Go ahead, go to the App Store, download El Cap, and go to town. Run your upgrade. And like I said, I think 98% of people out there are just going to be able to run the upgrader, do an over-the-top install, and you're going to be fine. So clean installs are only for those of us who are totally crazy, who have just built up a bunch of crud over the years. Everybody else, I would say, you're good to go. So that's it. That's upgrading to El Capitan. The other thing I realized this week is we really haven't talked about my thoughts on the new iPhone. Last week, we talked to Ara Derderian about the new Apple TV and those sorts of things, and we kind of skipped over the new iPhone. And so I do have a new iPhone. I upgraded from the iPhone 6S Plus to the 6S. Now, some of you are going to say, well, Adam, isn't that a downgrade? That's a smaller sized phone. For me, it's a massive upgrade. If you've been listening to the show, you know I tried. I promise you guys, I took a whole year to try to adapt to the larger size iPhone. And I liked a lot of things about it. I liked the optical image stabilization on the camera. That's been kind of hard to give up. I liked the little bit of extra battery life, although, to be honest with you, it didn't make that big of a difference because I'm the type of person, I have a charger in the car, I have a charger on my desk. I'm generally not running out of battery. I'm charging my phone, you know, usually every day. There were a few occasions when maybe I was out at a conference or wasn't, you know, near a power supply where it may have been an issue, but I generally don't have battery issues. If I have a phone that can make it a day and a half, and right now, honestly, the iPhone 6S seems to be doing fine in that arena, then I'm good to go. That really isn't a problem. And for me, on the size side of things, really what it came down to was my preference on how I like to carry my phone. I like to have it in my left front pocket. And with the iPhone 6 Plus, it was just too big. I couldn't leave it there because when I would sit down, it was either really tight or it would kind of dig into my leg. And so I was constantly having to take it out and put it in the shirt pocket. And then I have to do the Pledge of Allegiance thing when I bend over to make sure it doesn't fall out onto the phone or, you know, fall out into the toilet, whatever it might be. And it seems like a minor thing, but day in, day out, it just got a little bit grinding. And I always had my phone out, and I really don't like to do that, especially now that I have an Apple Watch. You know, I can get notifications. I can see what's going on my wrist. I really don't need to have my phone out in my hand or on the table or in my pocket, you know, shirt pocket. I don't need that much accessibility. So that was the main reason. And a lot of people have been asking me, you know, should I get the 6S or the 6S Plus? I really don't know. And unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess, it's a personal choice. You really have to decide for yourself. So I'm glad I did this experiment. I'm glad I took the year and really tried to see, is this a thing for me? And it just turned out not to be a thing for me. Is it a thing for you? I don't know. Only you're going to be able to answer that question. So I can tell you, you know, what my experience was, and you're welcome to draw from that, but you're going to have to make your own choice on it. The other thing about the new iPhone that I am a little bit, is it ambivalent, probably the word, about is the Touch ID. It has a faster Touch ID. As a matter of fact, it is lightning fast. It was great for doing the setup. Doing the setup was as fast as it could be. You know, that little thing where you go in and you got to keep pushing your finger on the Touch ID sensor over and over, and it's like, oh, adjust your finger, you know, move it around. That usually took a long time. This was like zip, 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 and it was done. Amazing. The downside of that, though, is I had been in the habit of very often waking up my phone by using the home button, you know, just like quickly pressing the home button just to get to the lock screen so that I could maybe see the time or see a notification that might be on the lock screen. If you try to do that now with a new iPhone, you don't see the lock screen. It just like, it flips on. You see the lock screen for a split second and then boom, you're at the, you know, you're at the springboard. It's crazy. So I'm having to retrain myself for those instances where I want to see the lock screen to use the sleep wake button. And when you think about it, that makes a lot more sense. It's called the sleep wake button for a reason, right? So having to do that. So that's great. I mean, it's good and bad, what have you. Really, the killer feature so far has been the 3D touch. And I didn't think I was going to be that into this. And it's a little bit hard to retrain myself to actually use it. But every time I use it, it is a magical experience. So whether it's, you know, 3D touching on an app icon to get the quick menu, or if it's using it in Mail or in Safari to bring up a web page, you know, on a link without actually having to click through just to see if you want to click through or not. You know, I'm finding new and great ways to use 3D touch all the time. And it's really, really cool. Something was happening the other day where I, you know, 3D touched on, a photo. I 3D touched on a photo, and there's this move that you do where you touch on it, you get the preview of it, but if you slide up, then you get additional, like, sharing options right there in the little, you know, peek panel. You don't even have to go all the way into opening the photo to get to sharing information or saving information for your camera roll. So that's really cool as well. And really time-saving. You're not having to do, just like they said in the announcement, you don't have to do a lot of the back and forth sort of operations that you had to do in the past. The one thing that a lot of people really like is the new 3D touch app switching, you know, sort of activating it from the left side of the screen. I find that gesture a little bit difficult to do. Maybe that, again, that's just a training thing. And for me, it hasn't been or hasn't seemed to be that much faster than just double tapping the home button. So I don't know if I'll ever relearn that gesture. But some people, you know, swear that that is the only way that they're going to do app switching from this point forward. That just didn't hit me like that. Live photos, kind of the last new feature on the iPhone that I've been playing around with. It's fun. It's fun to play with. It's interesting. I am enjoying having a live photo on my lock screen so you can kind of press it. Right now I have one of my dog. It's really cute, you know, and it's fun to show off to people. I have to wonder if, I think every year on the iPhone there's that one feature that Apple adds that's like the whiz bang. Oh, this is a really cool feature. But then a year from now, everybody sort of forgets and doesn't really use or play around with. It's the feature that I say gives good demo, right? It's the thing that you're going to show somebody. They're going to go, oh, that's so cool. I want that. And then find out that they never really practically use it. I don't know if that'll change once you can kind of share live photos onto services like Facebook and things like that. That may be something different. But I'm reserving judgment on that one for right now. Just a couple quick tips related to live photos if you're using them. You can turn them on or off. You can turn the feature on or off. There's a little icon that appears. It looks like a little circle, kind of starbursty thing in the camera application. You may want to turn it off because a lot of times when you're just looking at the photo in the photos application or the camera roll, there's really no indicator that it's a live photo or not. And if you share that live photo out, especially to someone on iMessage or a Mac, anybody running iOS 9, they can view that live photo. And if you think you're just sending a static photo and it's just one image, you might not know what is in the second and a half before and the second and a half after that photo. And so you got to be careful about content that might go out that you might not be aware that it is going out. And the way the live photos work is actually it's a still JPEG and then a low frame rate video, about 12 frames per second. So you have the JPEG file and then you have a separate movie file and they're all kind of bundled into one file. And so to you and to most people, it just looks like a JPEG image. And actually, I think if you send it to someone who is on a device that doesn't support live photos, I think it actually strips the movie information out. Not positive on that. I've seen conflicting reports. But it's a 960 by 720 movie file. And another good tip when you're shooting live photos, if you want to take a live photo, make sure that you, after taking the photo, you kind of leave the camera up for about a second and a half. Because if you start moving the camera down, you end up with these videos where in the last half of it, all you're seeing is the floor. So you kind of have to retrain yourself to actually take live photos. And they can be viewed on other iOS devices that don't, you know, are not an iPhone 6 or 6, or there I did it again, see, that are not an iPhone 6S or 6S Plus. What people can do, since they don't have the 3D touch to activate it, is you just do a long touch. So kind of touch on the photo in Messages or wherever it gets sent to, and you can view it there. There will also be support for it in photos in El Capitan. And if you want to import the photo and get the two separate files, a great way to do that is to use the image capture application in OS X. So rather than going through the Photos app, open up image capture and you'll actually see the separate JPEG and movie files, and you can import them separately. In El Capitan, in Photos, it shows up as a single file, but if you double-click on it, the video part will start playing, apparently. Again, I haven't upgraded yet, so I haven't been able to test out that feature, but that's what I've been reading. So overall, really enjoying the new iPhone. It is the first one that I've purchased that is not space gray, so I ended up getting a white and gold one with a blue leather Apple case, and I think the color combination looks great. I'm actually really enjoying that. And it's the first time I've ever noticed that when you reboot the phone on this one, you get a white screen with a black Apple logo, I guess because it's the white version of the phone, versus what I would always get on my space gray iPhone was a black boot screen with a white Apple logo. So nice little color-coded touch. I mean, that's the kind of stuff Apple does that's really nice and not always expected. Well, I guess expected from Apple, but, you know, most people don't take that attention to detail, and I thought that was a nice little touch. So we are going to talk a little bit about iPhone 6S and 6S Plus tricks, just some things. I think a lot of us know the kind of big main features, but I discovered in doing my research this week and just playing around with the device a couple little tips that I think are really helpful. 3D touch, you can actually adjust the sensitivity if you need to, so that, you know, how hard you need to press to activate the 3D touch. And that is set up in the accessibility settings. So if you go into settings, general accessibility, under 3D touch, you can adjust that. Another cool little 3D touch tip is you can get a trackpad as part of the keyboard. So if you 3D touch on the keyboard, say when you're typing a note or something like that, you can slide your finger around and move the cursor around the screen. So it acts almost just like a trackpad, similar to doing the, you know, two-finger trick on the keyboard on the iPad in the updated operating system. And another thing is when you are tapping or 3D touching on an app icon that's been updated to support the quick actions feature, if you're not seeing it come on, you do need to open up the application first. So the first time after you upgrade, you're going to have to open up the application one time. That'll sort of enable and activate the quick actions feature, and then you should be able to 3D touch on that icon from that point forward. Another cool feature that the new iPhones have is Wi-Fi calling. If that's supported by your carrier, it's not something that is turned on by default. You actually do have to go in and enable it. So again, if you go into settings under phone, you'll see a new section and you can tap to turn on the Wi-Fi calling features. In the U.S., I don't know how it is globally, but in the U.S., I know that it's being supported by T-Mobile and I believe Sprint. AT&T is waiting for an FCC exemption related to accessibility features, something that is supposed to be there for hearing impaired, and with Wi-Fi calling isn't supported, so they're hoping to get an exemption from the FCC to allow them to roll out the feature without that in place. They're actually trying to get the rules changed so that texting sort of covers the accessibility features for hearing impaired people. I guess the current laws, the way that they're written, aren't set up like that, but the other carriers apparently aren't waiting. So you may go in to turn on Wi-Fi calling and it'll say that it currently isn't supported by your carrier. That's probably what's going on there. Not all carriers are supporting it. It's not in all regions yet, so it's being rolled out slowly. But Wi-Fi calling is basically the feature that if you're in an area and there's not good cell coverage, but there's Wi-Fi available, you can actually place your phone calls over the Wi-Fi and do it that way. I think it still counts against your minutes and all that stuff, but at least you can get out and get a phone call made. Another thing related to the Wi-Fi to be aware of, and this could really impact your cellular data, is another new feature is something called Wi-Fi assist. And this means that if you're in an area and you're using data and you don't have a good cell signal, or flip that around. I just got that backwards. So if you're in an area where you have Wi-Fi, but the Wi-Fi ends up being weak and you lose Wi-Fi signal, it will automatically switch over and use your cellular connection. And unfortunately, this feature is turned on by default on the new iPhones. And so you may want to turn that off. It's in General Settings, Cellular, and you have to scroll all the way to the bottom. This one's a little bit hidden. So you scroll all the way to the bottom past all of your applications, and you will see Wi-Fi Assist. I've immediately turned mine off because, you know, if I don't have Wi-Fi, I don't want it to automatically flip over and start using my cellular data connection. It's not going to affect any of your other settings. So if you set up specific apps to say, you know, it's okay for this app to use data on cellular, that's fine. It's just in this scenario where you have a weak Wi-Fi signal and it's switching over to cellular. Another feature that a lot of people were looking forward to with the new iPhones is the ability to shoot 4K video. Luckily, that is not turned on by default. And I say luckily because 4K video takes up a lot of storage, about 300 to 400 megabytes per minute of video. So that means if you shoot 10 minutes of 4K video, you're looking at about 4 gigabytes of data. So shoot 30 minutes, and guess what? 12 gigabytes are gone. If you have a 16 gigabyte iPhone, you're going to be running out of storage. So it's not on by default, but if you do want to shoot 4K video, it's relatively easy to enable. You just go into Settings, into Photos and Camera, and then tap Record Video, which is near the bottom, and then tap 4K HD at 30 frames per second. And then once you've enabled that feature, you will be shooting 4K at 30 FPS. And then, of course, to turn it back off again, you can go in, and there's other settings in there that you can play around with to find, you know, the appropriate video quality to storage ratio on your device. Here's a cool thing, again, related to live photos. Remember how I said if you have a live photo, it's kind of hard to tell whether or not it's got the live content in there? And if you're going to share it out, you may want to be careful because you don't want to share out the video. Maybe you just want to share out the still. You can actually toggle the live version on feature on or off on your photos. And the way you do this is you select the image either from your camera roll or inside the Photos application, and then tap on the Edit button. And when you tap on the Edit button, then you'll see the little live photo icon in the editing controls. Again, if it is a live photo. And you can toggle the feature on or off. So you can tap it to turn it off, and then when you go share the file, it will share it just as the JPEG image. And if you toggle it back on and share it out, it will get shared out as a live photo. So it's non-destructive. You can turn it on or off at a whim. And I thought that was a handy tip to know related to live photos. And then finally, last little tip I have for you is actually a bug. Some people have noticed a display issue, and I'm bringing this up because a couple of you emailed me about this. A display issue after upgrading from an iPhone 5, 5S, or 5C to an iPhone 6S or 6S Plus. And what's happening is in some screens, they will get permanently zoomed in video. It particularly happens in the Wallet application, but also some other apps. The bug is reportedly fixed in iOS 9.1 Beta 3, but until that comes out, the workaround seems to be turning off display zoom. So if you go into Settings, Display and Brightness, under Zoomed, change the setting there, and then relaunch the affected app. So I think you have to go into Zoomed mode, relaunch the affected app, and that seems to resolve the issue, at least temporarily, and then you can go back in and turn off the display zoom. So I don't know if it's a permanent fix or if you're going to have to keep toggling that, but hopefully Apple will get, you know, 9.1 out here in the next month or so, and it will be fixed for everyone. But if you've been suffering from that issue, give that a shot, and that could possibly help you out. Another thing that was released recently is watchOS 2. I've been playing around with that a little bit and thought I should share my thoughts on that. Couple of different areas to talk about there. The new watch faces. So you now have photos, photo albums, live photos, and time lapses. Great features, you know, the ability to go in and use one of my own personal photos as a watch face or use a photo album where it'll, every time I bring up my wrist, show me a different photo from my photo album. The live photo thing is really cool. They've got different cities, and depending upon the time of the day, it will show you a different view of that city. So they, for example, have New York or London, and during the day you get this nice time-lapse shot, and when you bring up the watch to look at the face, there's a little time-lapse movie that runs, and then you've got the time. It just runs for a couple seconds, and then it goes static. So you have that. I guess that's the time-lapses one. And then the live photos one, I don't know if I've played around with that one too much. But the reason I'm not using these watch faces is they don't have any complications associated with them. You only get the date and time. And I guess that makes sense, so you're not covering up the photos. But generally, one of the reasons I like my Apple Watch is I like to be able to see more information like my calendar and some of the great third-party complications. So that's another feature in watchOS 2 that's great. Third-party apps can now add complications. So like, for example, I use Fantastical as my main calendar app, and they have a complication now. So I can get my Fantastical information right there on the face of the watch. You do need to install an updated app that supports the complications. And you do need to go in and enable the complications in the complications area of the Apple Watch app. But once you've done that, they'll show up as you go in to modify your watch face if that supports that particular complication. My only complaint there is they seem to be in alphabetical order, and the names can be confusing sometimes. It's sometimes hard to tell, is this a third-party complication or is it the built-in one? There's not a really good indicator, and you just have a couple of letters there to kind of say what the complication is. So that's been a little bit confusing to me, but overall I'm really liking, the ability to have third-party complications. Time travel is also an interesting feature. That's where you can turn the digital crown on the main screen and you can go forward or backward in time. Really helpful if you want to see, what's on my schedule for later today or tomorrow, something like that. It even affects things like the weather. So if you want to see, what's the weather going to be like tomorrow, or is it going to be raining in an hour, if you're using, say, like the dark sky complication, that could be really helpful. So you don't have to pop open an app. Nightstand mode, I haven't played around with very much, but this is the thing where you can connect it to the charger and then set it on its side. And then you can just press one of the buttons, either the side button or the digital crown, to see a digital readout of the, date and time. And if you set an alarm, this is kind of cool, you can tap the digital crown to act as a snooze button or the side button to do on-off on your alarm. So I could see that could be really helpful if you travel a lot, maybe when you're at the hotel. For me, I guess maybe it's because I don't use an alarm that it just hasn't been a really big feature for me. So I haven't messed around with that too much. With watchOS 2, you can reply to mail email now using dictation, which is really helpful. So if you get an email notification, you have the ability to reply to that. You also now have the ability to add more than 12 friends to the friends area in the whole, what do they call that, digital touch section, and you can even have groups, so you can group different friends or coworkers, or I guess it doesn't just have to be friends, they call it the friends section, but you can do that. Multicolor sketches in the digital touch, and there's some new animated emoji support for transit. A lot of these things I haven't really played around with too much. The multicolor sketches are kind of fun, but again, I don't use digital touch. Remember how I said there's always that feature that's like the it gives good demo feature, but a lot of people really don't use? And I know now I'm going to get a bunch of emails from you saying, I use that feature all the time. I absolutely love it. I guess, until my wife gets an Apple Watch, I'm probably not going to use it too frequently. I really think that's the spouse's feature, or maybe if my kids ever get an Apple Watch, that'll work as well. I also don't use transit directions because, I live in California and we drive cars. I think if I lived on the East Coast, maybe New York, that's a bigger feature, or Boston, something like that. some great new updates to the music application that are really handy. You now have a bunch of shortcuts for accessing things like Beats One Radio, the My Music playlists, your playlists in general, or also just viewing and accessing the Now Playing screen. And there's this cool thing called a Quick Play button that when you tap it will either give you shuffled music from your own library if you don't have an Apple Music subscription, or if you do, give you a randomly selected playlist or artist collection from Apple Music. So that's really handy. Something that I noticed after upgrading that I don't think was there before is the Apple Watch has the ability, if you're separated from your iPhone and you're on a known Wi-Fi network, to connect to Wi-Fi and enable you to still access, you know, the cloud sort of features. And I noticed the other day that I was away from my phone, but I was on my home network, and I was bringing up a glance, and I noticed that it had a little cloud icon now showing that I was on, indicating basically that I was on Wi-Fi and not going directly through my watch. And I hadn't really noticed that before, so I thought that was a nice little touch. And then lastly, a whole lot more Siri support. So Siri can do much, much more on the Apple Watch. And that really is, you know, voice seems to be the killer interface for the Apple Watch. So it now has support for Apple Music and HomeKit. I'm hoping to get some HomeKit devices at some point and be able to play around with that. It will auto-send your text messages. You're still able to cancel them, but you can have it auto-send the texts. So the minute that you dictate into Siri and say, hey, send so-and-so a text, she'll just send it off. You don't have to kind of do extra button presses. So that's really handy, especially if you're in a situation where that's not safe. Another thing that's really handy is Siri will now continue to process even when you put your wrist down. So even if the watch face goes to sleep, if she hasn't been finished processing that request, she'll continue to work on it and finish it up. That was always really annoying before. I had a lot of problems with that. You can use Siri to start your workouts. So for exercising and doing those sorts of things, you can say, hey, Siri, start a 20-minute, you know, run, outdoor run, those sorts of commands. You can open up your applications, and you can also now get definitions. You can do calculations. There's just a whole bunch more things that you can do with Siri on the Apple Watch with the Apple Watch 2.0 update. So all in all, you know, I'm kind of happy with the Apple Watch update. I don't think it's any big sweeping changes, but a lot of really nice new features and enhancements that make using the Apple Watch even better. So I am enjoying the update. How about you? You know, chime in. Give me your opinion. What do you think about the new Apple Watch update, the new iOS update, El Capitan? I mean, lots of updates, great updates that we can go back and forth on. If you found some cool tip or feature, please send those in. Always looking for great content from our community to share with you, and look forward to hearing your comments. And speaking of some of those comments, I had asked a while back for your feedback regarding some of Apple's announcements that they made back at their event when they announced things like the iPad Pro. And Cesar sent this comment in.
Hey, Adam, how you doing? This is Cesar from New York, and I just wanted to give you my impressions regarding the Apple keynote and the iPad Pro. If it does what they say it's going to do, it's going to be really a game changer. Specifically, the pencil, I think. If it can be used similar to what an Intuos Medium, what is pretty much the de facto in the fashion industry and also in teaching what we use, it's going to be fantastic. It's going to be a bridge between the physical and actually the digital, which is something that I always try to preach and always try to continue doing through the years. So if it can be done, that'll be really great. The touchpad, if it can be actually turned off while you're still using it, just like kind of a Wacom and the backlight's not showing, that would be actually even cooler. But if it's dual, where you see a mirror image, hey, you know what? I am not complaining at all. But again, thank you again. Wish you the best and keep on doing what you're doing. And I hope to hear more great news and info from you extremely soon. Ciao.
Hey, thanks, Cesar. Yeah, you know, I am getting totally excited about the iPad Pro and specifically the Pencil as well. I doodle around. I'm not an artist. I don't work in the fashion industry. It's not my business. It sounds like it, you know, in talking to you, that it is yours. I think it's going to be great. We're hearing a lot of great feedback about it, early feedback about it. I'm not sure you'll be able to use it paired with a Mac like you would an Intuos. So the idea of, you know, can I draw on my iPad Pro and have something happen on my Mac screen? I don't think that's something that Apple demoed. And I think that's what you're referring to when you're talking about having it mirrored. I think the intent with the iPad Pro is that you're going to just be, that's the screen that you're drawing on. And it's a little bit different than the Intuos because, you know, that screen has the ability, because it's an iPad Pro, to actually be running apps. Whereas the Intuos, you don't really have an app running on it. It's more like mirroring your screen, and it's a thing that you can draw on. At least that's my sort of understanding of how the Wacom and the Intuos works. This is a little bit different, right? You've got the actual, it's like drawing on the computer itself. So a little bit different. That said, I don't think there's any reason why what you're describing couldn't happen, or why Apple couldn't make it happen where, you know, it is mirroring my Mac screen, or maybe Adobe Photoshop that's running on my Mac, or some other application, and I'm drawing on it. So I think an app developer could use the technology that's in an iPad Pro to do a second screen kind of application with it. And that has some really interesting implications, I think. I think that could be some really new, innovative, interesting experiences that happen around that. So I fully expect developers to like push this thing forward, and I think it's going to be great. As far as how it's going to work, you know, is there no latency, the kinds of things, palm rejection, there's been a lot of questions. Something I got excited about this week, and I don't know if you saw this, is the folks at Pixar got some hands-on time with it. Specifically, people who work in the early stages of film development, where they're doing a lot of those sketches and stuff like that, they got to sit down with a couple of Pencils and iPad Pros and play around with them. And in general, I mean, the short synopsis is they were super impressed. And I would think those types of people, they're using high-end Wacom and Intuos tablets and stuff like that. They're going to be the type of people that are going to be hard to impress, you know, or they're used to, like you're saying, working more in an analog environment. They've got sketchbooks and things like that. So can this sort of bridge the gap between the physical and the digital? And they said it has near perfect palm rejection, I think was kind of one of the quotes, and that, you know, shading with the side of the Pencil was great, and it just no latency and everything. The more and more I hear about it, the more and more I'm getting excited. It sounded like in your comments you were excited as well. So looking forward to seeing this. It's going to be a long, like, 2 months now waiting for it to come out, right? We get it sometime in November, I think, is the release date. So I'm going to have a hard time waiting, but looking forward to it. I guess the Apple TV will maybe get us through this next month and then on to when we can actually have an iPad Pro and a Pencil. But certainly looking forward to it, and thank you for your great feedback. You know, I use tethering with my iPhone quite frequently. As a matter of fact, I gave up my grandfathered AT&T limited plan just so I could have tethering. I don't have an iPad that has Wi-Fi built in, and I specifically wanted the ability to use the iPhone tethering. And I have from time to time also used tethering on the iPhone with my MacBook Pro. And I've always done it through either Wi-Fi tethering or, I guess, Bluetooth, most often Wi-Fi tethering. But Nick wrote me this week to let me know that apparently with the release of iTunes 12.3, there is something that broke with iPhone tethering if you're doing it via a USB cable directly. So if you're using the Lightning to USB cable plugging directly into your Mac, you can do tethering that way also. It's kind of like almost using your phone as like a modem. And that apparently is having some issues for some folks. As a matter of fact, there is an Apple discussion thread that details the problem and offers up a fix. Apparently the issue, at least what's believed by those people in the thread, is that when Apple released iTunes 12.3, they replaced a kernel extension file, the Apple USB Ethernet host ktext file, which is found in the main system folder the inside the library folder inside extensions. And oddly enough, it appears that Apple might have forgotten to code sign that KText file, which violates the security and means that file does not load. And because that file doesn't load by the operating system, that's why it breaks the USB tethering. And I think the reason why it's believed that is the issue is because the fix is to use Time Machine or another old backup to go back and get a version of the KText file from before you ran the iTunes 12.3 update. And if you do that, go back and find the one with a timestamp of January 9th, 2015. That was the one prior to this latest update. The current one, I guess, has a timestamp of September 18th, 2015. That's the unsigned one. If you replace that with the January 9th version, everything will work fine, and you'll be able to do USB tethering again. I don't know if there's any other differences in those files, so I don't know if that, you know, Apple USB Ethernet host extension is used for anything else, and that may cause other issues. But until Apple issues a fix, if you do rely on that feature, you're probably going to have to do that. I do also want to point out another fix that I found as I was doing for the research for this online involves changing the boot arguments and putting KText into development mode. Do not do that workaround, because this will actually disable security for all kernel extensions, and that would let any unsigned kernel extension run on your Mac, and that would be a very bad thing. That's something, you know, like malicious software could cause a lot of issues with. So you want to leave that security protection in place. Just go back and get the older version of the file if you really rely on this, or simply wait for Apple to issue a fix or a patch. If you don't use the, you know, direct connect tethering at all, I don't think you have to worry about this. And I haven't seen reports from anybody to know if OS X El Capitan fixes this issue or not. But because Nick had wrote in and ran across this issue, I did want to bring it up with the community and just let you know in case you used this feature and were wondering why it was broken. All right, last thing I have for you is we talked a little bit earlier about backups and backing up and some of my backup strategies, and you know I'm a fanatic about this stuff. But I also have a couple of network devices, including a transporter. And Mike emailed or sent in this question about backing up that.
Hi, Adam. My name is Mike, and I'm a big fan of the MacCast, as I've been listening for almost 9 years now. I have a question for you. Not long ago, I purchased a transporter drive after hearing it advertised on your show. So far, I've been pretty happy with it, but I hesitate to put my most sensitive files on it because I don't seem to have any way to back it up. I know that I can use the sync folders to sync to a computer that is backed up, but I'm more concerned about the library folder that is accessible but not synced. I use CrashPlan to back up all my family computers. Do you know of any way that I can include my transporter drive as one of the volumes backed up to my CrashPlan account? Thanks for any help you can offer and all the hard work you do for the community. I look forward to many more years of the MacCast.
Hey, Mike. Yeah, I think what you're really looking for is a way to back up your transporter to the cloud. And because you have a CrashPlan account, that would be the most logical way to do that. Unfortunately, I don't know of any way to directly back up the transporter to CrashPlan in lieu of actually having an app that could run on the transporter to, you know, upload to CrashPlan. You're not going to be able to do that. And unfortunately, CrashPlan will not see the transporter drive on your network with how it's set up. So I didn't see any way to actually add the transporter, specifically the transporter library file, to CrashPlan. As you noted already, if you're doing the syncing thing, those files are easy to add to your CrashPlan backup. One method for getting a backup of your transporter would be to get a second transporter. So what you can do is get a second transporter and then claim that transporter under the same account. And then the two transporters will actually mirror each other, including the transporter library file. that may not be the most cost-effective way to do this, and you're still not getting a version backed up into something like CrashPlan in the cloud. I tested actually a method for backing up the transporter library that seemed to work quite well using one of my favorite archiving and selective backup tools, and that's an application called ChronoSync. I was actually able to select the alias of the transporter library folder within ChronoSync, set up a ChronoSync task, and back up the contents of the library folder. In my case, I had it back up directly to a Drobo that I had connected to my MacBook Pro via USB. It could have just as easily, though, been simply a USB drive that was connected to my Mac. And it did give me a warning that I needed to turn off a feature called Preserve Extended Attributes. And I guess this is something that controls the extended attributes on different file systems like NTFS and support some additional sort of metadata or information, I think, on your files. So you may not get an exact duplicate of the files that you're backing up, but in general, it seemed to work. I tried it with JPEG and iTunes movie files, basically M4V or MOV files. They seem to back up just fine. The one thing I did notice is that in my Drobo backup made through ChronoSync, they did seem to lose the custom sort of M4V icon. But I was able to pull the files back from the Drobo, play them just fine, so it didn't seem to affect the files themselves, maybe just some of the extra data, like, you know, the custom icon or something like that. So that may be worth a shot, because it's certainly better than no backup. And again, with the ChronoSync, you could, you know, back that up to an external drive and then set that external drive up to be backed up to your crash plan and sort of accomplish the same task. So that's a way to go. And I want to thank you for sending in your question, because it prompted me to think about talking about other kinds of backups. So on the show, I often talk about the, you know, what I call the big three sorts of backup, which is starting with Time Machine built into your Mac, simple and easy to use. Just get an external hard drive, plug it in, and say yes when it asks if you want it to be used as a Time Machine backup. The next one is some sort of clone backup, a bootable clone backup like SuperDuper or Carbon Copy Cloner. And then the last one being some sort of offsite backup, something like CrashPlan or Backblaze or, you know, a myriad of the other sort of cloud-based backup plans that you can sign up for. So you have those. The other kind of backup that I do, like I said, is this archiving and selective kind of backup, kind of going beyond Time Machine and clones and the offsite stuff. And I really like to use ChronoSync because it lets you set up and schedule these different kinds of selective backups. And you can back up network and connected volumes with it. If the volume is another Mac, like I back up actually some stuff to a Mac Mini that I have hooked up to a Drobo that's just sitting on my network. They have a companion application called ChronoAgent that makes that available to ChronoSync to be able to see that as a storage location and write backups to that. And so I use ChronoSync for backing up my critical local files to my Drobos. So things like my photo library or my movie catalog or my iTunes media folder, the Maccast folder where I record all of the Maccasts. I don't leave those all on my local hard drive, but I want to have archived backups of them. I have a task set up to automatically move those over to a Drobo. Client folders, my sites folder for my web development work, all of my web development projects, those sorts of things. These are critical files that, yes, I have in all of those other, you know, they are in Time Machine, they're in CrashPlan, they're in my, you know, synced backup, but I really like that peace of mind of having another one. And as a matter of fact, like my Maccast files, those aren't necessarily in all of those locations. You know, I want an archive of those on the Drobo, and I want those in CrashPlan, but I maybe don't have them in my Time Machine because I've already moved them off of my main hard drive that Time Machine backs up. So this is another way to get that third backup of those files. And one of my absolute favorite features of using ChronoSync is it has the ability to not synchronize deletions. So this is great for things like my iTunes media folder. So when ChronoSync backs that up to my Drobo, if I delete a music file or I delete a video, or even better yet, if iOS goes, or if the iTunes goes in and deletes a application file for one of my iOS applications, that does not get deleted from my archived backup. Those all stay there. So I have every version of every app that I've ever run on iOS. And that's come in handy in these times when Apple pulls an app from the App Store, because I can actually go back in and get the IPA, the original iPhone application file, and restore that back and get that synced back over onto my device. And that's worked more than once. So ChronoSync is a great backup tool that I don't mention very often that is well worth looking into. The other kind of backup that I don't talk about too often, but I do, that's sort of outside the big three, is email backup. A lot of people like to use their IMAP folders and their synced email as their backup, right? You may do this yourself. You keep every single email you've ever received, you've ever sent, anything that's ever been in your trash, and you just leave it on the server. And the problem with that is, one, if you don't have an email provider that gives you unlimited storage, you can run out of storage space and you might stop being able to send or receive email. The other thing is you don't really have it locally. You don't have it on site, as it were. You know, with IMAP, that stuff is up in the cloud. Yeah, maybe you sync it to your local email client if you're using Apple Mail or something like that. But I like to have another secondary backup of that. And, you know, the other thing is like, if you have a super large IMAP folder, that can slow things down. I mean, I've seen people with, you know, 20 gigabytes, 50 gigabytes, several hundred gigabytes of email on their IMAP server. And it's hard to search. It slows things down if you're in different email clients. So the backup solution I like to use for email is an application called Mail Steward. And what it does is you set it up and it scans your mailbox folders and then copies and creates an indexed archive of that into a MySQL database that's actually stored locally. They actually, for the standard version of the application, use a SQLite database. So it really just ends up in a single file. And the app has a user interface and it has a tool to let you search through your archived email and access that stuff. It also has the preferences so that you can tell it which mailboxes that you want to back up. For example, I don't back up my trash folder or my spam folder for obvious reasons, right? I don't need to store that stuff, especially the spam. I want that stuff gone. I don't care about it, right? That's fine if that goes away. But I certainly want to back up my custom, you know, mailboxes and folders and my inboxes for all my various accounts and things like that. And you also have the option to store or not store attachments. So you can have it actually back up attachments as well. And it has a great UI. It's very easy to set up and use. And it's kind of one of these set it and forget it sort of things. And you can put it on a scheduler. So I have mine set up to, I think, every 6 hours, scan through my mailboxes and back up the information that's in them. And also once a night, I have it set to go through everything and back it up. And what's great is once it's in there, if you want to bring it back, you can export mailbox files that can be simply re-imported back into mail.app. And it's been really great. And so what I do is I don't worry about the email that's in my IMAP folders or my inbox. I only keep about a year's worth of mail in there. And anything older than that, I delete because I know those are in my Mail Steward files. And my Mail Steward files are also backed up to CrashPlan and to my SuperDuper and in Time Machine. So I have never lost an email since using Mail Steward because I know it's always there in that database. And it sort of gives me that peace of mind. And it lets me keep my main email boxes relatively clean and clutter-free. You know, just about a year's worth of email stored in there. And even that gets pretty large. You know, that can be 1 to 3 gigabytes of data. I use the standard version of the application, like I said, which uses a MySQLite database. They also have a light version. If you have, you know, not a lot of email, that'll probably work for you. I think it has a couple hundred thousand email limit, where the standard edition doesn't. And I like that because it gets backed up to Time Machine Super Duper. They do also have a pro version, but for that, you do have to have a full MySQL database installed. So it's a little bit trickier to set up and configure. I think for most people, the standard edition will work just fine. So just a couple of other kinds of backup that you might want to think about, some things that I do that I wanted to share with you on this episode. And again, Mike, thanks for your question. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. Remember now, too, you can get 20% off new purchases of PDF Pen Pro, PDF Pen, or Text Expander for Mac. Just go to smilesoftware.com/MacCast or use the coupon code MacCast at checkout. Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. And TunnelBear. TunnelBear is a really simple VPN application that allows you to browse privately and get around blocked websites. You can try it today by going to tunnelbear.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me email or audio attachments. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. If you'd prefer just to call in and leave a voicemail, you can call the listener hotline. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. And you can leave voicemail there, or if you prefer Skype, my Skype handle is the MacCast. You can leave voicemail there as well. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you use the social medias, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. We also have a MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or if you prefer Google+, we're there as well. The MacCast Google Plus community is at google.com/plusMacCast, and that's the plus symbol. Look forward to seeing you online between shows, but until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.